With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later in the show, hear why California growers are encouraged to plan ahead after troubles this year with pests and disease. But our top story today, retail food and feeding advocates joined the American Farm Bureau to press for improvements in any new farm bill. The message was the same as AFB's. A new farm bill is needed urgently. Leslie Saracen heads the Food Industry Association, representing thousands of food retailers and wholesalers.
As of September 30th, there was a provision that ended and has not been extended, and we don't know what's going to happen. And that relates to the transaction fees that are associated with SNAP purchases and other government-provided programming.
Saracen told a National Press Club gathering, food retailers already have a razor-thin profit margin.
We on the retail side will continue to pay our part of the transaction fee that's associated with that. But the other side now is not required to pay that part of the transaction fee. So then the question becomes, are we going to have to pay that at the retail sector as well? And in a business that over the last 40 years has averaged a 1 to 2% margin, that's just not sustainable.
Nor, says Feeding America CEO Claire Babineau-Fontenot, is the same spending for a growing, hungry population, as she calls for a doubling of Farm Bill emergency food aid.
I think it's regrettable if we have resolved that the best we can do is what we've done. So I actually don't embrace the idea that we can't do more in this Farm Bill.
But unless more money is found, the tug of war between Farm Bill writers over farm versus feeding programs is likely to continue into the new year. With interest rates going up, there's still no slowdown in farmland prices or buying. David Geiger has this report.
With harvest nearly complete, many farmers in the Midwest have been surprised with yields despite drought causing concerns in the growing season. That's according to Doug Hensley with Hertz Farm Management. He says overall it's been a solid year, but regardless of yield changes, the growing season looks to end with lower commodity prices, down 20% in corn year to date. Another difference, the higher interest rate.
Long-term mortgage rates for farm real estate purchases are approaching 8%, whereas they were as much as 3% lower than that a year ago. This change has not yet significantly impacted land prices because people aren't financing a majority of land purchases.
Thanks to record farm income for several years, more farmers are able to buy land with cash. Hensley says financial security is powering land purchases, keeping prices stable.
You can see how interest rate increases have changed parts of our economy, however, including the residential real estate business here in 2023, as home sales in most areas have now slowed.
That same slowdown has not yet happened in farmland, but Hensley says it's still something to watch. Overall sale volume with farmland looks to be normalizing.
With mostly estate settlement sales, as well as input prices for the 2024 crop, and input prices have been comparatively lower this fall. In contrast to lower commodity prices and higher interest rates, which are kind of a wet blanket to the market, fewer sales and lower input prices are both supportive to land prices as we end 2023, so kind of offsetting factors.
Hensley thinks there is stability in land prices this fall.
As is typical, the best farms have a large audience and can still fetch a big number. We're finding the market is not as deep, especially for lesser quality farms. I don't describe the market as necessarily better or worse than a year ago, but it is different and can require a little more creativity and work to find competitive buyers on all farms.
Again, Doug Hensley, President of Real Estate Services with Hertz Farm Management. I'm David Geiger.
National Farmer Union President Rob LaRue supports the finalized Transparency in Poultry Grower Contracting and Tournaments rule from the USDA under the Packers and Stockyards Act. He says monopolies in agriculture have put the squeeze on farmers and consumers for far too long. LaRue says, quote, poultry growers face an especially unfair contracting system that's opaque and secretive. He goes on to say this finalized rule issued will require poultry companies to be more honest in their dealings with growers. He also calls this good news for family farmers and says it will bring strong rules to promote sorely needed transparency for livestock producers. The final poultry rule is the first of several updates USDA wants to make to the Packers and Stockyards Act. USDA also announced efforts to increase competition and innovation in seeds, improvement to USDA meat procurement requirements, and the establishment of a new chief competition officer position at USDA. Prices paid for crop seed increased significantly faster than the prices farmers received for crop commodities between 1990 and 2020. During that period, the average prices farmers paid for all seed rose by 270%, while the crop commodity price index rose by 56%. For crops planted predominantly with genetically modified seeds like corn, soybeans, and cotton, those seed prices rose by an average of 463% between 1990 and 2020. During that period, GM seed prices peaked in 2014 at 639% above the 1990 levels. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports, including our livestock report with Randall Wiseman, when we return. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's national spotlight, another successful trade mission for USDA. Here's Rusty Halverson.
USDA Undersecretary for Trade Alexis Taylor recently led a trade mission to Southeast Asia. The trip included stops in Malaysia and Singapore.
We've had over 300 business-to-business meetings, but I think more impactful is the quality of those meetings, the interest of the buyers that I heard from our businesses on. In Southeast Asia, one of the reasons we focused trade mission here and or continue to focus some of our trade missions here is the population dynamics that we are seeing. They have a growing middle class.
She says demand remains strong for American commodities.
There is strong connection to the United States, a preference for U.S. food and agricultural products. There's a lot of trust in our quality, safety, reliability as a trading partner, which makes this a very attractive set of markets.
Meanwhile, economist Dr. Steve Meyer says U.S. hog producers have been dealing with losses worse than 1998.
The real problem right now is that the prospects for next year are not a lot better. They're better, but not anywhere near good. We have three situations that have one or more of three things have to change. We either have to get costs down, we have to get demand up, or we have to get supplies tightened. One of the three.
Of the three that Meyer listed, pork producers are only responsible for supplying the pigs.
Costs are going to go down a bit from where they are this year, but they're still not going to be very low. My model has $90 break-evens for that low-cost 25% of producers, and so that would put the average producer somewhere in the 96 range for next year. And if you look at the futures market, there aren't any profitable prices on there right now.
Dr. Meyer says wholesale demand has strengthened since summer, but won't be going back to 2021-2022 levels, which means supplies need to be reduced.
And so if you're raising more pigs per litter, then you've got to cut your sow herd even farther than what you thought.
Economist Dr. Steve Meyer.
The annual election cycle for USDA Farm Service Agency County Committee seats now taking place through December 4th. Rod Bain reports.
Election Day 2023, the date November 7th for primarily local-based positions this year. A day earlier, another form of election began its voting cycle, the race for USDA Farm Service Agency County Committee seats.
The FSA is unique in all of the federal government in that it does have producer-based county committees to help with the delivery and implementation of the policy decisions that are made within the 52 programs in the Farm Service Agency.
FSA Administrator Zach Ducheneau says this year's county committee election voting period runs until December 4th. As for duties of county committee members,
as a member of the county committee, your job is to represent your producers as stakeholders in the delivery of FSA programs.
7,700 producers serve on more than 2,200 county committees across the U.S.
County committees are comprised from 3 to 11 elected members from their local administrative areas, and each member will serve a 3-year term. County committees are local ag producers who help ensure fair and equitable administration of FSA programs in their county or their multi-county jurisdiction, and they're under the general supervision of the appointed state committee, and they really serve as the eyes and ears of the producers who elected them.
Another important role of the county committee is
they are the supervisor, in fact, of the county executive director. So they'll weigh heavily in the decisions that are made with regard to selection of new CEDs.
Elected county committee members will be sworn into office on January 1st of 2024. Administrator Ducheneau says for more information about Farm Service Agency County Committees or the County Committee nomination and election process,
you can find a lot of that information on our website at fsa.usda.gov/elections. You can also stop in at your local office.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wiseman with today's Livestock Report.
Well, in today's livestock news, a new rule will enhance transparency in the poultry industry and establish a more level playing field for contract growers. With more on that story, here's Gary Crawford.
Reduce deception, increase transparency, and for contract poultry producers, create
a more level playing field for these growers.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack telling reporters this week his department's about to publish a final rule that would require poultry integrators to create and give to potential contract growers what's called a live poultry dealer disclosure document.
This document is designed to provide a realistic set of outcomes that growers can expect before they make an important contracting decision or before they make key capital investment decisions.
The document would lay out specifics about such things as costs and facilities requirements and what happens if a flock is hit by a disease outbreak. In other words,
to better inform growers in terms of what they're getting into, if you will, during the course of their arrangement.
He said this is just one of several rules being developed to improve fairness in livestock markets and competition in those markets. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. Well, the USDA did release a package of rules and orders seeking to increase competition in the livestock industry. That package establishes a chief competition officer at USDA's Ag Marketing Service. This position will be hired as a career rather than a political appointment. The officer will help elevate and institutionalize competition-related concerns at USDA. The package also updates AMS institutional meat purchase specifications that large volume buyers like federal, state, and local government agencies, schools, restaurants, hotels, and other food service users follow when buying meat products. And the American Sheep Industry Association wants to remind producers that registration for their 2024 convention continues. It'll be held at the Sheraton Denver Downtown Hotel. Early bird rates apply through December 8th. All online registrations must be completed by December 18th. After that date, you'll have to wait till you sign up on site. The convention will offer producers a closer look at two pieces of legislation that will greatly affect the industry. One of those will take place during the opening session on January 11th. It'll feature officials from congressional ag committees discussing the new farm bill. Whether it's passed by then or it's still being hashed out in the U.S. House of Representatives and U.S. Senate, there will still be plenty to talk about for American sheep producers. The other one will take place on January the 13th, the speaker lunch. It'll feature representatives from Superior Farms discussing a petition in the city of Denver to prohibit processing of livestock within the city limits. If passed, the petition would force the closure of Superior Farms lamb processing plant that is just minutes from the Sheraton Denver Downtown Hotel where the ASI annual convention will be taking place. To learn more about this and to learn how to sign up for the convention, go to their website, sheepusa.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Ag trade missions are a critical component of keeping American farmers competitive in the global market. On a press call from Singapore, USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, Alexis Taylor, said that the multiple trade missions she's led this year have been enlightening.
One of the things I have really taken away is there is a strong desire for U.S. food and agricultural exports. We are known as a quality supplier. There is confidence in the U.S. label when it is on a packaging for safety, for reliability. And so we are a desired trading partner. But I think the other one that really impression has really come out to me is we need to be showing up in these markets. If they are new and emerging markets for us, they are for others in the world as well. And our competitors are here and they're showing up and they're working on building these relationships as well. And so we need to be equally as aggressive. I think that's one of the reasons why we are so excited that we have recently announced the new RAP program, the Regional Agricultural Promotion Program, to really help our sectors, our agribusinesses, our food and agricultural sector across the United States continue to invest in these really growing and dynamic marketplaces to continue to be competitive, to be able to continue to show up, because that showing up is so important in building relationships and strengthening those relationships.
USDA's Agricultural Research Service recently inaugurated the SAMFAR United States Crop Improvement and Protection Research Center in Salinas, California, with a ribbon-cutting ceremony. The 117,000-square-foot facility is an expansion of the existing ARS Crop Improvement and Protection Research Laboratory, featuring advanced labs, greenhouses, and increased capacity for scientists. It will accommodate personnel from ARS, USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, and UC Davis. The facility's technological advances emphasize its role in addressing viral, fungal, and bacterial diseases affecting agricultural production. Dedicated to retired Representative Sam Farr, who advocated for the project during his 23-year tenure in the U.S. House of Representatives, the center symbolizes collaboration in fruit and vegetable research between USDA and partners across California and the United States. One of the many challenges for farmers and ranchers is the consistently increasing cost of energy. Western Ag Processors Association President and CEO Roger Isom said the coming increases are only the tip of the iceberg for what's expected down the line.
Most of the rate increases are for wildfire protection, the undergrounding of lines, insulation of wires, things like that. We have not seen the infrastructure increase yet that's going to be necessary to implement this conversion of all of our trucks and forklifts to electric, the conversion of homes to all electric, the elimination of natural gas for heating. There is tremendous infrastructure that's going to be necessary. PG&E said it in the meeting I was at. Every 20 megawatts, another substation needs to be built. Well, if every DC fast charge electric truck charging station is a megawatt, how many of those stations are we going to need to install? And correspondingly, how many substations are going to have to be built? And wires and poles. It's absolutely unfathomable where we're headed and what the cost is going to be, because that's not coming out of the shareholders. Again, it's coming out of the ratepayers. We have not seen the entire iceberg yet. There's a lot to come. Not only that, you know, solar now is relatively cheap, but we're going to offshore wind. We're going to other energy sources. What's the cost of that going to be? Because they're going to have to procure that all of that power to supply all these charging stations and everything that's electric now as it starts to kick in over the next few years.
There was heavy pest and disease damage in almonds this season, largely attributed to the wet weather earlier in the year. BASF Tech Service Rep for the Southern San Joaquin Valley, Kevin Caffrey, said bloom disease was especially prevalent.
Many times in the more southern portions, say Kern County, you're not going to see as much bloom disease, but that wasn't the case this year. It came up heavy. And then later on, a lot of the injury, especially some of the insect injury like NOW or leaf-footed plant bug, a lot of it came down to people trying to sharpen their pencils. And I think people took the gut approach of, hey, let's cut some sprays. And unfortunately, now that everything's coming off the tree, they're noticing that you may not want to do that in a year like this.
Caffrey said growers will want to plan ahead in the event of another wet winter.
Certainly have some places to pivot, either reducing a spray, adding a spray, going less intense or more intense. You have options now. So I think that's the big thing. Certainly coming out of a wet season with a lot of disease, there's a ton of inoculum out there. So you may want to plan ahead for, especially in almonds and really all of our crops, that disease is going to be a bigger issue than normal. And especially if we have a wet winter, I mean, conditions are going to be very prevalent to it. I think now that people are seeing some of the injury, both to their trees and to their yields, I think a lot of people are starting to think more, let's be strategic. It's really easy to spend yourself broke, but you also can't save yourself to prosperity. So you really have to plan ahead and how best do I manage my crop for the future.
The second State of the Tulare Basin Conference is coming up later this week. Hosted by the Tulare Basin Watershed Network in partnership with UC Agriculture and Natural Resources and Secure Water Future, the conference is scheduled for Wednesday, November 15th. This year's State of the Basin Conference theme is Managing Hydroclimatic Extremes and will be taking place at the UC A&R offices in Tulare. The event will provide a forum to increase awareness on the history of the basin and discuss challenges and opportunities brought about by the recent droughts and floods. The emphasis remains on promoting a whole watershed approach, connecting upper and lower elements for building social, economic, and environmental resilience in the region. The event brings together leaders, practitioners, and experts from diverse backgrounds and sectors to explore the environmental, economic, and social changes occurring in the region. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
This is the Agnet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. The USDA has a report coming out this week that will shed light on the current state of the cattle industry and what consumers may expect to pay for beef. Rusty Halverson reports.
USDA will release a new cattle on feed report this Friday. Cattle producers have yet to pull the trigger when it comes to herd expansion. That according to Kansas State University Extension livestock market economist Dr. Glenn Tonser and the latest cattle on feed numbers.
Heifer inventory was up 1% versus the year before, and heifers composed 40% of the total inventory. So the remaining 60, of course, are steers. But anytime we have that high as a percentage of the inventory, then that's historically at least a pretty strong signal that, you know, ranchers are not keeping their heifers at home. They're still finding their way to the feed yard. And it's another, you know, fairly direct signal, at least to me, that nationally we have not pulled the trigger on expansion.
Tonser says there's a lot of talk about herd rebuilding. While some herds are in the process, collectively, the national numbers don't show that herd expansion has begun.
Mother nature, drought conditions, those kind of things definitely have a hand in this. Borrowing rates, you know, interest rates are a lot higher. There's still several that remember they paid up a lot in 2013, 2014 for replacement heifers, and a couple years later they weren't as happy with that. That's, you know, as of today, that's my crystal ball forecast, but I don't think we've done it yet.
One study that Tonser conducts on a regular basis is feedlot profitability. His latest numbers suggest there's still profit in the feedlot sector, but not as much as a few weeks ago.
The main thing to probably highlight here is compared to a month ago, these, at least on the front end, these first, you know, 4 or 6 months projections, they're a fair amount lower than they were before.
Last month's cattle on feed report showed cattle on feed at 11.5 million head, the second highest figure on record. American Farm Bureau Federation economist Bert Nelson.
We have a lot of cattle that are being placed on feed, and a very high percentage, near 40% of those cattle, are still heifers. And in the short run, this means that we're going to have a very high supply of cattle coming to market at one point in time. But in the long run, this takes a lot of cattle out of the market that could have otherwise been held back for replacements.
Replacements, of course, are what help rebuild herds following a dip in herd numbers.
Replacement heifers are basically the planting intentions of the cattle business. So when we have less of those replacement heifers being held back to produce calves, we ultimately have a smaller inventory. We've been going through this for a couple of years now, but now as this happens, we're looking at 2024 at the earliest before we can even consider starting to replace this cattle herd.
Nelson says consumers will likely feel the pinch of higher beef prices next year.
A lot of the economy situations, we're talking about recession, we're still talking about inflation and where our money's at, are going to dictate the ability of the economy to sustain these high beef prices, or if consumers will start switching over to other substitutes like pork and chicken.
I'm Rusty Halverson.
A proposed Forest Service change could lead to more carbon storage. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The U.S. Forest Service proposed a change in regulations that would allow it to consider requests to inject carbon dioxide beneath the 193 million acres of national forests and grasslands. Currently, the Forest Service is barred from authorizing exclusive and perpetual use and occupancy of its land by outsiders, a prohibition that would apply to carbon storage because the gas would remain underground for hundreds of years. The proposed regulation would create an exemption for carbon capture and storage projects. If approved, the USDA could authorize proposed carbon capture and storage on National Forest Service system lands where and if it's deemed appropriate. Public comments on the carbon injection idea will be accepted until January 2nd. The Forest Service says the proposed rule would harmonize carbon storage regulations with the Bureau of Land Management. The BLM issued its carbon storage policy in July of 2022. Hosting this year's Thanksgiving dinner, an expert has some advice about how much turkey to buy. Gary Crawford has more.
Ah, hunting. It's that time of year when many of us go out hunting for a turkey. Oh, no, no, not out in the wild, as some do, but at the supermarket. Now, over the last couple of years, some of us have had to scale down the number of people at our Thanksgiving dinners. I remember Agriculture Department food safety expert Meredith Carruthers telling me 2 years ago,
we are just going to do a little small get-together this year.
Aha, but this year, it looks like many of us are going to have more folks over for dinner. Now, Meredith works with the Agriculture Department's Meat and Poultry Hotline, the number of which we'll give you in a minute. She says one of the big questions that they get on the hotline is, how big a turkey do I need to buy for the number of guests that are coming? And Meredith, what do you tell them?
So we generally recommend to follow about a 1 pound per person rule, and then about a pound and a half if you would like to have leftovers. So depending on your party size, depending on how many people are eating, usually about a pound to a pound and a half per person.
Now, as far as shopping for that turkey, Meredith says it's important to know that the longer that raw meat or poultry is at room temperature, the greater the chances that any bacteria that might be in or on it will multiply, especially if it's out of the freezer for more than a couple of hours. Of course, yes, that turkey is probably frozen, but the thawing begins when you take it out of the frozen meat counter.
So if you have a big grocery shop, if you're going to the grocery store to get everything for your Thanksgiving meal, we do really recommend to try grabbing that turkey towards the end of your shopping trip, so it's not taking a ride in the cart for many minutes or hours, even sometimes in the store, that you're getting it towards the end and it's going straight from the refrigerator case to checkout, to the car, to home, to the refrigerator.
And it's in the refrigerator that Meredith recommends thawing that turkey. That way the thawing takes place, but the bird's temperature stays below 40 degrees and below the temperature at which bacteria can multiply. But thawing in the refrigerator will take some time, about 24 hours for each 5 pounds of turkey.
And it is safe to keep that turkey in the refrigerator 1 to 2 days after it is fully thawed.
And if you have other questions about preparing that holiday meal, call the folks at the Meat and Poultry Hotline. Here's the number, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, or go online to ask.usda.gov, ask.usda.gov. The experts, including you, Meredith, will be working even on Thanksgiving Day from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Right, Meredith?
Yep, we are getting ourselves ready to answer calls rapid fire.
That's right. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Brian German has today's interview segment. Here's Brian.
CPA with Pinion Global, Tommy Urban, joins us today to highlight some of the most pressing topics that you've been dealing with this year. And but before we get into that, Tommy, let's get a quick snapshot of what you do and some of the assistance you can provide the ag industry.
Yeah, so we're a CPA and consulting firm specializing in food and agriculture. We do all of the traditional CPA services like tax returns, tax planning, financial statements, audits, reviews, all those types of things. But we've really tried to take get a critical depth in that food and agriculture space so that we can help our clients at a deeper level. So we do things, you know, from sustainability consulting to federal affairs lobbying. We get into the automated back office with our Pinion IO service. We do help with payroll and human resources. So kind of, you know, as we've gotten to know our clients better and gotten to understand their needs, we've added a lot of services to help solve some of the issues that they face on a day-to-day basis.
So with a pretty broad variety of issues that you deal with, in your particular focus area, permanent and specialty crops, what are some of the major things that you're seeing a lot of interest in or fielding a lot of questions about?
Yeah, you know, every day is a little bit different, but, you know, probably I would say three common ones that come up on a regular basis. One would be rising costs, being in that rising cost environment, and how do I control costs and really understand where my costs are going to, what can I save on, what's driving the bottom line of my business and what isn't, so that I can really focus my effort on what's doing that. So we hear a lot about that, just with commodity prices being down in several different commodities, you know, almonds, walnuts, you know, there's several others that people are trying to pay a lot more attention to how to cut costs, but still drive the business forward. So we get that a lot and have some things that can help with that. Another one we're getting pretty regularly is around sustainability. We're hearing, especially at the kind of once you get up that vertical out of production agriculture, but into, you know, kind of the processing and marketing entity, they're really starting to getting pushed by the larger retailers on sustainability and getting that information all the way back to the farm level. So we provide some sustainability consulting and really kind of help line some businesses up with what they're currently doing and how they match with the retailers and what their expectations are, and then possibly some things they can add that would open up additional doors to them. And then being that we kind of work up and down that vertical, we can oftentimes help bridge that gap between, you know, the retailer to the food manufacturer or processor, all the way down to that field level production agriculture. And then the other one we've been hearing a lot lately, which is relatively new to permanent and specialty crops, is around FSA and USDA payments. So, you know, in the last 5 years, I would say that's really become more of a hot button issue because, you know, historically there haven't been a lot of payments available to the specialty crop market. So with this latest ERP 1 and ERP 2 and PARP and now the 2022 ERP program, there's just a lot of confusion, you know, among growers. Are they filling their applications out right? Do they qualify? What do I need to do to make sure my farm is eligible? And we have an entire FSA team with former kind of regional directors throughout the country operating that can really help solve some of those issues that our clients are facing.
And drilling down on that a little more, since it's something new, like you noted, and so there's naturally a lot of questions around it. What are some of the avenues to help producers navigate some of these programs? I mean, what are some of the questions that you're fielding there?
Yeah, I mean, the USDA, you know, they've done their best to kind of release frequently asked questions and fact sheets around the programs. But oftentimes the language is driven more towards someone that really understands, like a CPA or, you know, some of the terminology that they use. If you're a grower trying to fill out your own application, a lot of times you're like, well, what's adjusted gross income? I don't know what that is. So really helping kind of go through some of those basics in the forms, but then also the setup around how do I become eligible to even receive FSA payments? There's a lot of reporting and entity level reporting, then also at the individual owner level, just become eligible, actively engaged in the business, what kind of debt or capital you're providing to the business. And there's some hangups around that. Has there been ownership changes, which could affect eligibility? Am I above AGI limitations for payments? There's a lot of things around the kind of that $900,000 AGI and some misconceptions with that, especially being in a community property state. And then as the programs come out, it's really kind of diving into not just the basics of, okay, this number goes here, this number goes where, but take ERP, for instance. You have a base year that is considered your normal year of farming. And then you're looking at an allowable year where you're measuring whether your income went down or not. So what if you increased acreage over that period? Your income might have gone up, but because you're farming a lot more than you were in that base year. But really, you should be eligible for payments because you've been impacted dramatically by drought or whatever the emergency might have been. And so how do we get those types of producers to qualify? You know, we go through that a lot, too.
And being that something is new, there's always a lot of questions and a bit of a learning curve. But it sounds like with the questions you're fielding, seems like there's quite a bit of industry response and interest there.
Yeah, definitely. You know, with commodity prices being where they're at, there's, I think some of these programs have really, between crop insurance and these direct payment programs, they've really helped save a lot of farms from being in a distressed situation. So the industry groups have done a really good job kind of pushing that information out that, hey, this program's coming out. Okay, now you can sign up for it. We get forwarded a lot of emails as those industry association they're sending those out. So I know that those are being well received and people are paying attention to that. Anytime they hear that there's additional money on the table, they get pretty excited. So
Yeah, absolutely. And again, Tommy Irvin with Pinion Global joining us here today. And Tommy and some of the other Pinion team will be out at the upcoming Almond Conference in Sacramento. They'll be in booth 1429, available to answer any further questions that industry members might have.
Thanks, Brian. This is the AgNet News Hour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. A new partnership will send teachers to the Farm Bureau Convention. Rusty Halverson has more.
The American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture and Nationwide have teamed up to bring outstanding educators to the American Farm Bureau's annual convention coming up January 19th through the 22nd of 2024. Selected educators will receive an inclusive and immersive experience. They'll receive free registration for the convention in Salt Lake City, as well as financial reimbursement for travel, lodging, and meals. The experience will connect teachers with farmers and ranchers from across the country to hear directly about modern farming. Highlights will include participation in local ag tours and networking with farmers, ranchers, and other professionals. Daniel Malloy, executive director of the AFBF Foundation, says they're proud to support teachers from all across the country in several ways, hoping to give them new ideas to bring back to the classroom.
Experts expected that U.S. agricultural exports would take a hit in fiscal year 2023, and that's exactly what happened. Gary Crawford reports.
We finally got the complete U.S. agricultural export numbers for fiscal year 2023, which ended September 30th. So how did we do? Drum roll, please.
Agricultural exports were $178.7 billion.
USDA economist Bart Kenner says that's 9% below 2022. Sounds like a big drop, yes, but Kenner says you have to put it in context.
We had some pretty big spikes in the past couple of years in agricultural exports. A lot of that spurred by exports of grains and oilseeds to China in particular.
2022, a phenomenal export year with dollar amounts off the charts. So Kenner says this past year, instead of being viewed as a horrible year, is instead actually
kind of a return to more normal trends in terms of agricultural trade.
Trends affected by generally lower commodity prices and a strong U.S. dollar, making U.S. products less price competitive on world markets. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
USDA last week announced a new initiative designed to support and expand markets for our country's specialty crop industry. Here's Rod Bain.
New ways to support the nation's specialty crop industry.
I'm pleased to announce that USDA is investing $70.2 million. In the Specialty Crop Research Initiative, which will support 21 research and extension projects. One of the things that USDA does that I'm most proud of is linking the research to the implementation. And the extension service is such a crucial part of that. Cooperative extension agents are trusted partners who live in the communities they serve, whether it's learning how to make your pecan meatier in Georgia or addressing challenges with citrus greening in Florida or water management in Arizona. All of these are opportunities to connect the research that's being funded by USDA to the work on the ground. The awarded projects address key challenges of national, regional, and multi-state importance to the food and agriculture industry, including conventional and organic food production systems. The Specialty Crop Research Initiative prioritizes projects that improve crop characteristics, manage threats from pests and diseases, improve production efficiency, profitability, and technological innovation, and it mitigates food safety hazards. The Specialty Crop Competitiveness Initiative is being launched by USDA as a new initiative to support U.S. specialty crop businesses facing rising challenges in remaining competitive in domestic and international markets.
Deputy Agriculture Secretary Xochitl Torres-Small discussing the new initiative with reporters Thursday. It contains an online resource directory with USDA resources and services for specialty crop producers and businesses.
That can be found at www.usda.gov/specialty-crops. And we're hoping that if you prefer, especially with long days farming, accessing a website might be more helpful in your own time.
She adds USDA will engage with the specialty crop industry in the coming months to improve response to grower and business needs. Also announced, over $70 million in funding for 21 projects under the Specialty Crop Research Initiative. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That is today's top agriculture news. I am Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.